This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Fiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, TriMet begins using biodiesel to fuel its buses. Mexican federal police move into Oaxaca City to take it from residents. And Republican Representative Duncan Hunter announces he will run for president.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,814 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers since we invaded and 101 dead in October. In Iraq, bodycount.org reports as many as 49,760 civilians have been reported killed by our invasion. A report in the medical journal The Lancet puts the number at more than 600,000 civilians dead.
Starting today, TriMet becomes Oregon's number one biodiesel user. All the system's buses will begin using a biodiesel blend. The transit agency will use about 300,000 gallons of biodiesel a year, more than Oregon's next three top biodiesel users combined. TriMet's fleet has also begun using ultra-low sulfur diesel, which cuts sulfur content in diesel fuel by 97%. After successful trials, TriMet is now expanding biodiesel to its 611 fixed-route bus fleet. Combined, the fuel will cut particulate emissions up to 30% and reduce greenhouse gases.
Portland Mayor Tom Potter today said he'll ask city officials for $250,000 this year to fund crisis intervention training for officers and another $250,000 next year. It was not immediately clear how the move will change the current police practices in dealing with people with mental health issues. The Bureau already offers such training, but it is voluntary. Potter said the money will come from the city's unanticipated revenue fund. Potter is rounding up support from other commissioners who will have to vote on November 29th on how they can allocate the extra revenue the city has collected. Currently, there are more than 150 Portland crisis intervention trained officers. Of those, 103 officers are on the streets assigned to the Bureau's five precincts. Since the training program began in 1994 under former Chief Charles Moose's direction, it has been voluntary. Mental health advocates have urged the police bureau to expand its specialized training ever since the September 17th death in police custody of James P. Chass, Jr., a 42-year-old man who suffered from schizophrenia. Three officers involved in Chass' death were not CIT-certified officers.
Oregon families, be careful when looking for inexpensive toy jewelry as a Halloween treat or for pirate and princess costumes. Those cheap jewelry items could be exposing children to toxic lead. KBOO's Ross Egan has the story.
The greatest threat to your kids this Halloween may not be the tummy ache from too much candy. It could actually come from their costume. Some toy jewelry used in costumes or given out as treats may contain toxic lead, according to a warning from the Sierra Club. Spokesman Eric Antebi says despite serious health hazards for kids, lead is still commonly used in both costume and children's jewelry.
Avoid glossy, fake-painted pearls, which may be painted with lead paint. Avoid purchasing toys from vending machines. Find out what stores and suppliers and manufacturers have said no to lead.
The Sierra Club has petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to keep toxic toys off the shelves. They also recommend having your child tested regularly for lead poisoning and asking stores for documentation that their children's products do not contain lead. And Tebby adds that it's especially important to be careful with toys for small children.
Toy jewelry made with lead poses a particular problem because of the high likelihood that young kids put them in their mouths and may even swallow them.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, about 300,000 American children have blood levels high enough to cause irreversible damage. For KBOO News, I'm Ross Egan.
An Eagle Point woman who ingested coffee pot cleaner at Rogue Valley Medical Center is suing the medical center. And she wants people to know that people aren't always safe in the hospital. Patricia Richardson was visiting her father in 2004 after he had been admitted for cancer treatment. She said his health was failing fast and swallowing liquids was difficult. So a nurse put a thickening agent in the water to make it easier to go down. But it wasn't a thickening agent and it didn't thicken. So they put in two more scoops before her father asked her to taste test the water, which turned out to have the coffee pot cleaner in it. The hospital staff sent Richardson to the emergency room for treatment when they realized they put coffee pot cleaner into the cup of water instead of the thickening agent. Employees said that in their deposition that the coffee pot cleaner was in a disposable plastic cup in the kitchenette for patients. A housekeeper said she intended to label the chemical, but she did not have a marker on her cleaning cart.
Ted Kulongoski says he expects the next legislature to take on the touchy question of who should get Oregon driver's licenses, but that he won't take sides on the issue. Oregon is one of a handful of states that does not require proof of citizenship or legal residency for a license. It has become a high-profile issue in his re-election campaign against Republican challenger Ron Saxton. The question regarding the economic effect on Oregon if undocumented immigrants were denied licenses was asked Friday when Kulongoski appeared on a Spanish-language radio station, KWBY, in Woodburn. Kulongoski says he expects the legislature to bring Oregon into compliance with the federal Real ID Act, which would require proof of citizenship or legal residency before a license can be issued.
A question of whether juries should be allowed to award punitive damage is under attack. An $80 million verdict against the tobacco company giant Philip Morris is before the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. It's an Oregon case that is widely seen as a test of how the Supreme Court will interpret previous cases on punitive damages. The additional money is intended to punish a company or an individual for their behavior and to act as a deterrent. The case is Philip Morris versus Williams, and oral arguments are scheduled for tomorrow. A jury ordered damages to be paid to the family of Jesse Williams, a janitor who smoked three packs of Marlboros a day before he died in 1997 of lung cancer. Williams took up the cigarettes in the 1950s while serving in the Army in Korea.
A Bend woman who says she was attacked by two pit bulls last year has filed a $90,000 lawsuit against the dog's owners. Deborah Lohefner said she and her husband were walking their dog when a neighbor opened her door and the dogs bounded out. She said the pit bulls attacked her dog, a German Shepherd mix, then attacked her while she tried to pull them away. The pit bull owners could not be reached for comment. Lohefner said she was bitten on the knee and hand, which still causes her pain. She also said the attack has impaired her ability to sleep, prevented her from working, and that she has been in therapy since the encounter. She is asking for $15,000 for her medical expenses and $75,000 for physical pain and mental suffering.
A drive-by shooting occurred in Canby area this morning. Police were called at shortly before 2 a.m. on Knott Street after residents reported hearing two gunshots and a vehicle driving away. But the officers recovered three rounds from an apartment. Two rounds were found inside the apartment lodged in a couch, and the third was lodged in a step near the front door. But no one was injured in the shooting. Residents reported that the couch is where someone usually sleeps, but he was not there last night. Police say the apartment has ties to the Norteno gang and is believed to be targeted as a retaliation for a beating involving a rival gang member a few days before.
Albany police have arrested a 44-year-old Albany resident on 25 counts of encouraging child sexual abuse. David Jonathan Brown is being held in the Linn County Jail. The arrest of Brown ends a two-week investigation into allegations that he had downloaded and stored large amounts of child pornography onto his personal computer. Albany police detectives say one DVD alone had more than 600 images. The majority of the children, some as young as 3 years old, engaged in sexual contact or lewd poses. The investigation revealed that Brown had been downloading and storing the child pornography for several years. The Corvallis Police Department Detective Unit is assisting in the investigation by conducting a forensic search of the computer and recovering the child pornography.
The Federal Communications Commission is reviewing its controversial rules on media ownership. On Friday evening, there was a hearing in Oakland, California, where the FCC's two Democratic commissioners heard the public's concerns. Eric Klein reports.
In 2003, under the leadership of Republican Michael Powell, the FCC voted to make it easier for a single company to own a radio station, newspaper, and TV station in the same region. That decision was overwhelmingly condemned by the public, and Congress overturned it. Jeff Perlstein is the executive director of Media Alliance, who helped organize Friday evening's FCC hearings in Oakland, which Pacifica station KPFA broadcast live. Perlstein spoke with the hosts of the KPFA broadcast about what has changed since the last time the FCC held hearings on media consolidation.
There's the technological developments that we've seen since the last round of hearings in 2003. But as significantly to the policy side and technology side, there's also the movement side that really has developed in a really significant way in the last couple of years.
Jonathan Adelstein is a Democratic commissioner with the FCC.
Well, it's actually good news that we're here again because we were able to win last time. The then-chairman Michael Powell proposed the most destructive rollback of media ownership rules in the history of American broadcasting. The public rebelled against it, as you said. The Congress rebelled against it. But most importantly, the courts ruled that the entire item needed to be thrown back to the FCC and we needed to start over again. So here we are starting from scratch, but we're further along than we were last time.
He says that's because the public is more aware now than they were 3 years ago about what's at stake when media ownership is consolidated. Michael J. Copps is the other Democrat on the FCC.
First, I hope we will do no further harm. The old Hippocratic oath. Let's not have rules like Michael Powell wished to have that would have allowed one company in the market to own three television stations, eight radio stations, the already monopolistic newspaper in that market, the cable system and the cable channels. How does that further localism or diversity or empower consumers? So the first thing we have to do is make sure that doesn't happen. If you look at the comments, and we're only starting to look at them now, that have come in attending this new media ownership proceeding, they just came in this week, it's clear to me that these companies want to continue going down the road of consolidation. They're trying to tell you and they're trying to tell the American people maybe they're not as interested in this anymore and they've learned the lessons of localism. Baloney.
Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee welcomed the FCC hearings to her district, downtown Oakland.
This is so important because as we see this push to promote democracy abroad, what we see here in our own country is a shutdown of democracy. And that is what media consolidation is all about. In a real democracy, corporations should not control the airwaves.
One of the many members of the public who addressed the commissioners last Friday evening, James Burns.
There is going to be media ownership limits because that's what's going to save our democracy. I mean, that's what it's down to. And there is no such thing as free speech without government protection. Free speech is a political concept. This thought that the government censors us is not true. Corporations censor us. The government protects us from corporate censorship. Now, the largest contributors to presidential elections is the media industry. Okay, and they make the most money from elections, right? Because people have to buy airtime to get elected. So my idea to democratize the media in this country is to tax advertising. When a corporation buys advertising from a media company, they pay no sales tax on the transaction. Think of that. It would raise $2 billion a year for public access stations in every community, public broadcasting stations across the country, 100 of them.
The deadline for the public to respond to this first round of comments is December 21st. According to an FCC spokesperson, the commission has set no timetable about when it will vote on any new changes. The next public hearing is set for November in Seattle, Washington. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Washington school districts are asking the courts to throw out the state's system of financing special education. They say over 120,000 students are being shortchanged by Olympia. A loss could cost the state at least $100 million a year in more generous budgets. 12 districts from around the state went to Thurston County Superior Court today, joined by Seattle, Tacoma, and 70 other supporting districts.
An Oakland company that makes touchscreen voting machines is requesting a federal investigation to dispel rumors of ties to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Sequoia Voting Systems Incorporated says it has asked the Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States to investigate it and its parent software company, the Smartmatic Corporation. The request comes after the news article suggested improper ties to Chavez. The, The focus is on last year's acquisition of Sequoia by Smartmatic, a Florida company owned by three Venezuelans, and whether Chavez's leftist government wields influence over their operations. A spokesman for the Treasury Department says the investigators have been in contact with Smartmatic, but she declined to say whether there was a formal investigation. However, no investigation has been ordered into the ties between all the other voting machine companies and leading Republicans.
Alarmed by attacks on evolution in the classroom, a group of Midwest scientists has recruited a candidate of its own for the Ohio Board of Education. The scientists, calling themselves Help Ohio Public Education, are backing former Representative Tom Sawyer over Republican incumbent Deborah Owens Fink. Fink has pushed for students in science class to be taught information for and against evolution. Voters in Ohio will pick five of the board's 11 elected seats November 7th, and the new governor will appoint four members. In 2002, the school board adopted science standards that encourage students to seek evidence for and against evolution. Last February, however, the board rescinded the policy. Last year, a federal judge barred the Dover, Pennsylvania school system from teaching intelligent design alongside evolution, calling it creationism masquerading as science.
The Orange County District Attorney's Office has charged 11 people with fraudulent voter registration. The charges stem from a Republican registration drive this year that resulted in dozens of Democrats unwittingly being signed up as Republicans. Those charged have been paid as much as $10 for each voter they registered as part of a Republican Party effort to recruit more voters in Central Orange County. The cases were filed Tuesday, and three defendants were arrested on Wednesday and Thursday.
The number of people who go online for political news is rising, with more than one-third saying they check the Internet for such information. This group is more likely to be younger, better educated, and more male than the population in general, an Associated Press News poll found. While 35% say they check the Internet for political updates about campaigns and candidates, that number grows to 43% of likely voters, and they tend to be more liberal than conservative. The most popular destinations are the news sites, such as those run by newspapers, networks, and news magazines, with 9 of 10 in the online political audience saying they go there. Just over one-third go to candidate sites, and almost half check out political sites.
The renowned liberal arts university for the deaf in Washington, D.C., Gallaudet University, has been brought to a virtual standstill by four weeks of protest. Both students and faculty have been trying to oust the proposed university president of Jane Fernandez. But today, they are celebrating a victory. On Sunday, Gallaudet's board ousted Fernandez. Nan McCurdy has more from Washington, D.C.
A jubilant atmosphere prevails for students as they end their fourth week of protests and return to class. The Gallaudet board yesterday revoked the appointment of Jane Fernandez, who would have become president in January. Student spokesperson Latoya Plummer through an interpreter.
We want to thank Gallaudet University's Board of Trustees for making the best decision in the best interest of this university.
Student leaders also won the demand for no reprisals, a point that Jane Fernandez would not guarantee. The 133 students arrested for closing down the campus 2.5 weeks ago may be asked to do community service, but will not be expelled. Students questioned Fernandez's leadership abilities based on low graduation rates during her tenure as provost, and protesters complained she did not enact an anti-autism mandate that would increase the faculty's minimum fluency in American Sign Language. Autism is a term akin to racism that describes negative or oppressive attitudes towards deaf people. Linguistics faculty member Deborah Chen Picken through an interpreter.
All of us involved, faculty, staff, and students, recognize that the level of American Sign Language that's used here is unacceptable. We need to raise that level of competency, raise it to the point that it's received a prestigious position and really honored for the language that it is.
Students who say the selection process was flawed have begun to negotiate with the board for a better process next time. Noah Beckman, student body president, through an interpreter.
We will ensure that the search process, which will happen shortly, will follow three basic concepts of justice, transparency, and inclusiveness.
For Free Speech Radio News from Washington, D.C., I'm Nan McCurdy.
California Governor Schwarzenegger.
In 2003, under the leadership of
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger plans to ship more than 2,000 inmates to other states to ease crowding in the nation's largest state prison system. Two California state employee unions are suing to block the move because the replacement prisons are privately owned and operated. The California Correctional Peace Officers Association and the Service Employees International Union Local 1000 say it's illegal for the administration to pay private prisons to house the inmates. The suit being filed in Sacramento Superior Court says the move violates the state constitution. It also says the governor overstepped his authority when he declared prison crowding to be an emergency. The administration says it's acting legally. The inmate transfers are set to begin next month.
A memo obtained by the Associated Press shows the Defense Department is adding to its public relations staff. It is setting up teams to quickly answer opponents' claims, develop their own propaganda, and coordinate politicians to speak out on issues. The Pentagon spokesman denies the new effort is aimed at shaping public opinion about the war or influencing next week's elections. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said it is the thing that has been keeping him up at night is his belief that terrorists have been able to manipulate the media. While the Pentagon communication efforts have been lacking. He once graded these efforts as a D or a D plus.
Scientists in the United Kingdom's Merseyside may have discovered the first drug ever to tackle the causes of Alzheimer's disease. Experts at the University of Liverpool say they are ready to test what could be a breakthrough treatment for Alzheimer's on mice bred with a rodent form of the disease. They have created a new compound called engineered heparins, made out of a type of sugar which naturally occurs in the body and is normally used to stop blood clots. Initial findings show it is between 50% and 100% effective at preventing clumps of protein forming in the brain, which disrupt normal brain functions and cause gradual memory loss. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. There are around 750 dementia cases in the United States.
The streets may be getting a little safer for police officers, but I don't know about the rest of us. New statistics from the FBI show a slight drop in the number of officers killed on a job last year, with a bigger drop in assaults. 55 police officers died in the line of duty in 2005, most of them while working for city police departments. Traffic duty was the deadliest job, with 15 killed in pursuits or after pulling someone over. About 1,800 fewer officers were assaulted on the job last year as compared to 2005. The FBI says many of the dead and injured worked on overnight and found themselves dealing with domestic disputes and bar fights.
A growing number of American farmers have become concerned with the potential effects of global warming and are adopting environmentally friendly farming methods and even recently purchasing hybrid automobiles. The industry has been especially aggressive in breeding and developing crops that more efficiently use soil moisture and nutrients. Such crops can ward off disease and pests that stress plants trying to cope with increased temperatures. Others in the industry are using improved soil management methods to reduce greenhouse gases. That includes no-till farming, where farmers plant crops without using machines to plow or turn over the soil. That method cuts down on energy use and traps organic material that breaks down to fertilize the soil. The method also keeps carbon in the ground instead of releasing it to build up in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Farmers also are planting crops that require less fertilizer and herbicide applications, using alternative fuel such as ethanol and biodiesel, capturing methane gas released from livestock operations for energy production, and harnessing wind power.
Department of Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff claims that increased border security operations have met with success. But immigrant rights advocates say Chertoff's policies have been devastating to immigrant communities. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff praised the results of the first full year of new border security policies.
We started to have a deterrent effect on their willingness to come and try to cross the border.
Secretary Chertoff's media briefing compiles the data from an entire year of immigration enforcement. But the statistics don't differ much from the last briefing he gave 2 months ago. But the timing is opportune, just 8 days before Election Day, where the Republican Party, who prides itself on being tough on border security, is at risk of losing the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate to Democrats. Secretary Chertoff highlighted multiple DHS programs aimed at curbing unlawful immigration. The hiring of an additional 1,500 border security agents, the awarding of government contracts to develop a technological border, expedited removal of undocumented immigrants, and interior enforcement at the workplace, which has deported 180,000 immigrants living and working in the U.S., Chertoff says. All of these initiatives, Chertoff says, has reduced the number of immigrant arrests by 8% compared to last year. To DHS, that means fewer people are attempting to cross the border.
This kind of totally comprehensive strategy is what is required if we are going to solve this problem that's plagued the country for decades once and for all.
But Jason Ackleson, assistant professor of government at New Mexico State University, says a variety of factors determine how busy the border crossings are.
Weather, for example, has something to do with the amount of people crossing, the economy, another. So it's difficult to totally isolate one thing as being the only factor in changing apprehension policy.
Plus, Ackleson says the latest numbers don't give the whole picture.
They say they're up by 8.4% compared with FY 2005. And if you do the calculation on that, that looks like this year something like 1.2 million people were apprehended on the border, which is an increase over 05 and 04. But actually, if you go back to 2001, in that fiscal year, 1.2 million people were apprehended, so we're about on par there. And then in 2000, 1.6 million people were apprehended. So it's important to sort of see this in the larger context of immigration policy that tends to kind of ebb and flow.
Reverend Luis Cortez is head of Esperanza USA, an evangelical group that has several million followers across the country, many of them Latino. He says the focus on border security and interior enforcement without complete immigration reform is having a devastating effect on many families in his community.
The immigration reform means that sitting at a table today, you have a family of five, a family of seven, a family of eight, and each one has a different status. It's really hard on a lot of our families. Most of the undocumented in this country didn't climb over the border. They came in legally. INS is broken, so their choice is to leave the country or to stay in the country illegally. And so they stay, but they have jobs, they have families.
Border security and targeted arrests of undocumented immigrants are currently the only components of immigration reform. President Bush signed into law last week a bill that authorizes the construction of 700 miles worth of fence along the U.S.'s southern border. Although that law is unfunded, $4 billion have been allocated so far this year in congressional appropriations to implement other border security provisions. In his briefing, Secretary Chertoff mentioned the need for a temporary worker program, which is backed by the administration, but does not go far enough for many immigration advocates. Advocates say a culture of fear has already been created among the immigrant community through increased detention, a decrease of judicial review, and the partnership of local law enforcement with federal immigration officials. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Kentucky Fried Chicken said today it is phasing out trans fats in cooking its original recipe and extra crispy fried chicken, potato wedges, and other menu items, but hasn't found a good alternative yet for its biscuits. Health experts say trans fats raise levels of artery-clogging cholesterol and contribute to heart disease. The restaurant chain said it will start using zero trans fat soybean oil system-wide in the United States, with the rollout expected to be completed by April 2007. The announcement came just ahead of a New York City Board of Health public hearing on a plan to make New York the first U.S. city to ban restaurants from serving food containing artificial trans fats. Artificial trans fat is so common that the average American eats 4.7 pounds of it a year, according to the Food and Drug Administration.
Michael J. Fox campaigned for Ohio Democratic Senate candidate Sherrod Brown today, saying the country needs leaders who support scientific research. Fox has Parkinson's disease, and he has been campaigning around the country for candidates who favor federal funding for stem cell research, which is widely expected to lead to a cure for Parkinson's. Brown, a congressman from northeastern Ohio, is challenging incumbent Senator Mike DeWine, who opposes federal money for such research. During a speech to about 150 supporters, Fox referred to the criticism he drew from conservatives last week after appearing in a Missouri political ad that ran during the World Series. Conservative talk show host and convicted drug abuser Rush Limbaugh criticized the ad, in which Fox was visibly shaking, suggesting he was, quote, either off his medication or acting, unquote. Fox said he was actually over-medicated and suffering from the unpredictable symptoms of Parkinson's.
Vice President Dick Cheney today linked the increase of violence in Iraq with efforts to torpedo Republican control of Congress. Cheney said he believed the attacks were timed to influence the U.S. elections. 8 days before the elections, Cheney sat down for interviews on the Fox News channel. Now, in its fourth year, the Iraq War is a political liability for Bush and Republican allies. Over the course of the war, more than 2,800 Americans have died. Cheney, who 17 months ago said the insurgency was in its last throes, said that he predicted a continued level of violence in Iraq. He said that unlike other wars, it was unlikely there would be some dramatic turning point that signals progress.
The Maine Coast Heritage Trust has exchanged a 3,000-year-old, 5.5-acre piece of land for an easement on coastal tribal land in Washington County today. The Passamaquoddy tribe celebrated the deal with a song and ceremony. The land called Picture Rock on Machias Bay is sacred to the Passamaquoddies. Thousands of years ago, Native people told stories here, carving pictures into the rocks called petroglyphs. For decades, Ann Thompson's family owned the land and took great care to keep it from being developed. Now Thompson and her husband have sold the land to the Maine Coast Heritage Trust, which then traded it to the Passamaquoddy tribe. The Maine Coast Heritage Trust paid $450,000 for the land at Picture Rock.
Nevada Congressman and gubernatorial candidate Jim Gibbons is asking a court to order the release of parking garage security videotapes. He says the tapes will show he didn't assault and proposition a Las Vegas cocktail waitress. A lawyer for waitress Chrissy Mazzeo wants police to reopen their investigation of Mazzeo's claim that Gibbons accosted her earlier this month. The 61-year-old Gibbons is running as a Republican for Nevada governor against Democrat Dinah Titus. The 32-year-old Mazzeo says tapes should show Gibbons tried to force himself on her in the parking garage on Friday the 13th, after a night of drinking with other people at a Las Vegas restaurant bar. Gibbons says he helped Mazzeo back to her feet when she tripped. Both have said they're willing to take lie detector tests.
The trial is scheduled to begin today in Olympia in a lawsuit over a dozen school districts that are suing the state over special education funding. The districts say the state has failed to fully fund classes for special education students. The lawsuit was filed 2 years ago, and more than 70 districts have filed friend of the court briefs with Thurston County Superior Court. The dozen districts in the school district alliance are Bellingham, Bethel, Burlington Edison, Everett, Federal Way, Issaquah, Lake Washington Kirkland, Mercer Island, North Shore Bothell Woodinville, Puyallup, Riverside Chatteroy, and Spokane.
Of the many disturbing trends for Republicans this campaign season, one of the most telling is the drop in support among evangelicals. A new poll by the Pew Research Center says 6 in 10 evangelicals support the war now, compared to the 7 in 10 who supported the war in September. It also shows more support for a pull-out timetable. 46% of white evangelicals favor a timetable, as compared to the 32% who favored a timetable in September. Pew Research information also indicated that the number of conservative Christians with a favorable view of the GOP has plummeted from 74% to 54% between 2004 and this year.
The current time is 5:34:35. Pacific Standard Time. Abandon all hope of seeing the sun until next spring. And now for another highfalutin' daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Bodies. Dead ones. Dead bodies are the harsh, horrifying, riveting realities of war. That's why those who make war don't want you seeing the bodies. Don't. Bodies. Dead ones. Dead bodies are the harsh, horrifying, riveting realities of war. That's why those who make war don't want you seeing the bodies, don't want you counting them or thinking about them. If you see, count, or think, you'll quickly question the war itself. Thus, from the start of George W.'s disastrous Iraq War, the White House and Pentagon decreed that there could be no cameras witnessing the return of America's dead from Iraq. The bodies arrive in the dark of night at a cordoned-off Air Force base. The media establishment has cravenly submitted to this censorship of truth. Also, even though nearly 2,800 Americans have died in Iraq, Bush has not honored a single one of them by attending their funeral, for to do so would call attention to the bodies and the real cost of his war. Of course, Iraqi civilians comprise most of the dead, including a startling number of innocent children and old folks. Morgues and other sources report that the number of dead civilians has now topped 40,000, with the rate of deaths increasing in recent months. This is an unpleasant and politically volatile count, so Iraq's central government has now decreed that only it can release civilian death counts to the media. But it seems that even 40,000 is a gross undercount. An independent statistical analysis conducted by a team of American and Iraqi researchers connected to Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health now estimates that more than 600,000 Iraqi civilians have died violently since Bush's 2003 invasion and occupation. The sight of dead bodies in the streets, in rivers, next door, on TV, has come to be an everyday occurrence for Iraqis. This is a major reason that 82% of the people there want U.S. troops to leave. This is Jim Hightower saying, don't avert your eyes from the bodies. Silently, the thousands and ever more thousands of dead bodies are telling us the truth about Bush's war.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Barry. Tonight's weather, some clouds today, but more sun tomorrow, in the Willamette Valley and the Columbia Gorge. Highs around 51 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Portland activists are staging multiple protests at the Mexican consulate today and tomorrow. KBOO's Lisa Loving has more.
Protest against the police killing Friday of Brad Will, a New York indie media journalist, filming an attack by riot police in Oaxaca. The Reuters news agency reported today that Mexico's lower house of Congress, the Chamber of Deputies, unanimously demanded that Oaxaca Governor Ulises Ruiz resign. Starting with a teacher's strike in May, protesters have camped out amid barricades in the popular tourist city. When it became clear Ruiz would not respond to the teachers' demands, a coalition of even more groups came together at the barricades, accusing Ruiz of corruption and demanding he quit. Federal riot police broke up the demonstrators' barricades and took control of the colonial city Sunday, after Ruiz had repeatedly called for federal forces to step in. Ruiz has flatly refused to resign. Indie Media, the activist web community, is mobilizing worldwide in solidarity with the Oaxaca demonstrators, even calling for anyone who was able to fly immediately to Oaxaca. In Portland, protesters held a vigil today at 11 a.m. and plan another to begin at 6 p.m. Tomorrow, protesters will be on site from 4 to 6 p.m. The Mexican consulate in downtown Portland is located at 1234 Southwest Morrison Street. Demonstrators are asking for Oregonians also to call the Portland consulate's office to demand an end of the federal police invasion of Oaxaca and an investigation into the Mexican government's use of plainclothes officers as paramilitary. That number for the Mexican consulate in Portland, Oregon is 503-274-1442. That's 503-274-1442. I'm Lisa Loving, KBOO News.
Mexican federal police have moved into Oaxaca City to take the city from residents who have been governing themselves for the past 5 months. Shannon Young reports on this weekend's events.
The helicopters started circling early Sunday morning and kept hovering over the city center into the night. It did not come as a surprise. President Vicente Fox announced Saturday morning that he would send the federal preventative police into Oaxaca. By midday Saturday, large numbers of the militarized police force, known as the PFP by its initials in Spanish, had landed at Oaxaca City's airport. The PFP operation on Sunday hit different entry points into the city. Tens of thousands of neighborhood residents came out to stand in front of a large PFP contingent as they advanced towards downtown along the superhighway from Mexico City. One of the most significant points of resistance was at a barricade installed at the Viguera traffic circle. Neighborhood women stood on the front lines holding flowers, Mexican flags, and religious symbols. others, like this man, drew blood in front of the line of watching riot police.
The government does not exist. The most correct thing is for you to speak to your superiors. The state government has so far killed 17 people. Are you going to add to that number? I'll leave that with your conscience and your big boss, Carlos Abascal and Vicente Fox, who should be here to see that we are not just a handful of people.
Police used tear gas, armored personnel carriers, and water cannons to try to move some 30,000 neighborhood residents from the highway into downtown. The demonstrators laid down in the street to impede the advance of the police vehicles. Unable to pass the barricade at the Viguera traffic circle, the police contingent took a different route, with support from helicopters. Along the way, at least two protesters were killed. 26-year-old nurse Jorge Alberto Lopez died instantly from the impact of a tear gas canister to his chest. Professor Fidel Garcia died from massive head trauma. A third rumored fatality is reportedly an unidentified 14-year-old boy. Presidential spokesperson Ruben Aguilar denies that anyone died in the police operation. President Fox announced the decision to send in federal troops after a series of deadly attacks Friday afternoon killed three people. One of Friday's dead was New York indie media videographer Brad Will, who was shot while filming a shooting attack on residents of the Santa Lucia del Camino municipality, just outside of Oaxaca City limits. An ambulance never came to the scene, and local residents did what they could to evacuate Will to the Red Cross. This man, who did not want to be named, was carrying Will when he died.
A truck came and we put in the compañero, who was between life and death. We and three others carried him. From there, we went to see where we could take him for treatment. But at that time, we didn't have help from anyone. Everything got more complicated when it started to rain really hard. Along the way, the compañero died, breathing his last breath at about four or five blocks before arriving at the Red Cross. And we left them at the Red Cross. In my arms, in our arms, the deceased man died. May the compañero rest in peace. And I'm also asking the authorities at the international level that they please look into this, because ya basta. Enough already. We are fed up with this government.
The gunmen in Santa Lucia were later identified in photographs as local police and former government officials. On the opposite side of town on Friday, a group of approximately 50 gunmen attacked a teacher's protest camp outside of the governor's offices. This teacher survived the volley of gunfire by running into a nearby house.
Bueno, fue un enfrentamiento que se dio de una forma.
It was a confrontation in which we were the cannon fodder, because we had nothing with which to defend ourselves. At the moment in which we hid in a house, in front of the camp were people armed with shotguns, pistols, and they weren't shooting into the air. They were shooting at people who were running desperately. Among those who were taking refuge in the house were fellow teachers, seniors, and even crying children.
The ambush outside of the governor's office left two dead, 15 wounded, and several people are missing. No one has been arrested in connection with the ambush. Although federal troops have occupied most public spaces in downtown Oaxaca, local residents are marching today to try to recuperate their plazas and to protest the federal occupation of their city. In collaboration with Indie Media Oaxaca, I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A couple of hundred protesters demonstrated for their support of the Oaxacan Teachers Union in a social struggle unfolding in Oaxaca, in New York City. Kat Aaron reports.
Over 250 people gathered at the Mexican consulate in New York City this morning to demand justice for murdered American journalist Brad Will and an immediate end to the violence in Oaxaca, Mexico. Will was shot dead Friday in Oaxaca while covering the months-long teacher strike there for the New York City Independent Media Center. Becca Economopoulos was a friend of Will's.
Last night there was a call from the people in Oaxaca that activists across the world go to local Mexican consulates and shut them down for the day to send a strong message to Mexico that they must pull out the police forces and the government troops from Oaxaca.
Friends of Will's locked themselves to the doors of the consulate and a lamppost. Will's former roommate Brandon Jordan blocked traffic by lying in the street. The New York Police Department blockaded 39th Street, physically pushing demonstrators onto the sidewalks.
Get on the sidewalk.
One demonstrator expressed his grief at Will's death and anger at the police response. Becca Economopoulos.
There have been at least 6 or 7 people arrested, and the protest continues. Hundreds of people are here, not just here, but in cities across the country and across the world, in solidarity with the people of Oaxaca, with Brad, and with the others who've been murdered. He has dedicated his life to going to the places where stories are underreported, of people standing up in the face of fear with courage in their convictions that a better world is possible.
Shortly after her interview with FSRN, Economopoulos was arrested, along with Diane Neary, an ex-girlfriend and close friend of Brad Wills. Demonstrations will be held at Mexican consulates in at least 13 other cities, from San Diego to Washington, D.C. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kat Aaron in New York.
The U.S. military has not properly tracked hundreds of thousands of weapons intended for Iraqi security forces and has failed to provide spare parts, maintenance personnel, or even repair manuals for most of the weapons given to the Iraqis, a federal report released yesterday has concluded. The report was undertaken at the request of Senator John Warner, who is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and who recently provided an assessment far darker than the Bush administration's on the situation in Iraq. The U.S. military did not even take the elementary step of recording the serial numbers of weapons provided to Iraqis, the inspector general found, making it impossible to track or identify any that may have fallen into the wrong hands.
Former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and British lawyer David Mills have been ordered to stand trial on corruption charges. Milan magistrates accused Berlusconi of paying Mills, the estranged husband of British Culture Secretary Tessa Joel. At issue is a kickback of $600,000 for not revealing the details of Berlusconi's media empire when Mills testified in 2 court cases. Both men have denied wrongdoing.
The British government is launching a bid to convince doubters that environmentalism and economic growth can coincide. A report released by the government today emphasized that global warming can only be fought with the cooperation of major countries such as the United States and China. Sir Nicholas Stern, the senior government economist who wrote the report, recommended a low-carbon global economy through measures including taxation, regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, and carbon trading. Treasury Chief Gordon Brown, who is expected to replace Blair as prime minister next year, announced today that former Vice President Al Gore would advise the British government on climate change.
Ivo de Boer, head of the UN Climate Treaty Secretariat, said the industrialized world's emissions of greenhouse gases are growing again. This despite efforts under the Kyoto Protocol to cap them and to stave off global warming. Haider Rizvi reports from the UN.
UN researchers say during this period, the Eastern and Central European nations were mostly responsible for more than 4% increase. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change requires 35 industrialized countries to reduce greenhouse emissions by an average of 5% below 1990 levels by 2012. The report urges the industrialized countries to invest in sustainable development projects in developing countries, besides introducing further cuts at home. The United States, the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, is not a party to the UN Convention on Climate Change. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
That was Ivor de Boer, head of the UN Climate Treaty Secretariat.
Nigeria dispatched 117 soldiers to Darfur today to replace a similar number of troops completing their tour of duty in the troubled Sudanese region. The Nigerian troops are part of the African Union peacekeeping force in Darfur, where rebel groups have confronted Khartoum in a civil war which has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands. Moves by the UN to deploy troops to complement the efforts of the badly funded African Union troops in Darfur have been fiercely resisted by the Sudanese government.
Colombia's second-largest rebel group, the National Liberation Army, has agreed to help demine several rural southern districts. The move will be the first concrete action taken by the group since it agreed to a peace process last week in Colombian government. The number of landmines victims in Colombia has grown, with more than 1,000 people injured in 2005.
The Philippine government is preparing to arm paramilitary forces. The government says those forces would fight against the communist insurgency, terrorism, and crime in the country. The plan comes amid a spate of extrajudicial killings that have been blamed on government security forces, raising concerns of more violence. Gurley Linao reports from Manila.
Recruitment is already ongoing for nearly 8,000 civilians who will be trained, armed, and deployed all over the Philippines to help the military and police fight enemies of the state. The civilian volunteers would serve as village defense forces who would secure areas already cleared of threats to allow soldiers and policemen to move on to their next targets. Brian Yamsuan, an assistant secretary of the Interior Department, said an executive order signed by President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo in July paved the way for the arming of civilian volunteers. Yamsuan said local governments would be funding the purchase of arms and ammunition for the militiamen, while the police or the military would be training the civilian recruits before they are deployed.
Part of the training will be on human rights, and we will try to make them apolitical. We don't want them to be thinking that because they were given arms, they are civilian volunteer organizations, or they are goons of the mayor, or goons of the governor. We want to train them that their primary role is to defend the republic and defend your locality in this fight against terrorism and counterinsurgency. We will identify their roles to be able for them to have the right psychological mind, also to avoid human rights violations later. Safety nets are a primordial part of this program.
But such assurances are not enough to allay apprehensions that the arming of civilians would only escalate a spate of extrajudicial killings, aggravate the climate of violence in the country, and even worsen the insurgency the government wants to eliminate. Marie Hilao Enriquez, Secretary General of the human rights group Karapatan, warned the government was treading on very dangerous grounds in arming civilian volunteers. She noted that in the past, the use of militiamen failed to wipe out the communist insurgency in the country and only resulted in rampant human rights violations, the proliferation of vigilante groups, and private armies of politicians.
They will only fan and worsen the insurgency that they want to stomp out. They will make it bigger, and there would be more chaos. There will be more killings. There won't be respect for human rights. Actually, this is an admission that they cannot govern. Because they are arming people, we will also take up arms. All the civilians will just take up arms. And what happens? We just shoot each other?
The strife-torn southern region of Mindanao has been identified as a pilot area for the deployment of armed civilian volunteers amid a clamor from local officials for additional security forces, especially after a series of bomb attacks that killed 6 people earlier in the month. Martin Dino, a village chieftain in a suburban city in Manila, said he supports the plan to arm civilians, particularly village security officers who are often the first line of defense against criminals.
Having a gun should not be a license to shoot anyone. The priority is self-defense. You will only use your weapon if your life is in danger while on duty. If you abuse this position, you have to be punished, especially if you use your weapon for your own interests. You should be the first to go to jail, and if there's a death penalty, you should be executed.
Dino complained that because village security officers are currently armed with only wooden sticks, they are often helpless against criminals who carry high-powered weapons, making their jobs sometimes deadly. The Interior Department said local governments were still preparing their plans for the arming of civilians, and there was still no clear timetable on when the program would be implemented. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
Fresh from a landslide re-election victory, Brazil's President Lula da Silva was set to begin talks today to forge a legislative agenda and a broad-based coalition of in the Brazilian Congress. Rosa de Caldas reports on the election results from Sao Paulo.
Despite all the recent government scandals, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was re-elected with almost 61% of the popular vote. His opponent, Geraldo Alckmin, as governor of São Paulo, garnered at just 39%. Lula justified his victory, arguing that it was a conquest of the Brazilian people and had satisfied him as a politician. According to research, Lula had the massive support of the poor and less developed people. He will lead Brazil until 2010. Rosa Caldas in São Paulo, Brazil, from Free Speech Radio News.
Two election workers in eastern Congo were shot dead shortly after second-round presidential elections ended today. The United Nations said the killings have been carried out by a Congolese army sergeant who appeared to be drunk. The shootings provoked a riot in which 43 polling stations were destroyed. President Joseph Kabila is facing ex-rebel Jean-Pierre Bemba in a runoff after neither managed to secure a clear win in August vote.
That's the KBOO Evening News for October 30th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and then leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203, provided you're not a terrorist. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. And you can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and wired editor for tonight's newscast was Mike Munkvold. Tonight's audio editors are Laura Young and Prentice Darden. Special thanks to reporter Ross Egan and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Eve Sokolai. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Andy Seaton, and I'm not a terrorist.
And I'm Lisa Lewis, and I am a terrorist. No, just kidding. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Topics will include the upcoming election. At 9, on Between the Covers, the guest is David Edmonds, co-author of Rousseau's Dog, Two Thinkers of War in the Age of Enlightenment. At 9:30, it's Words and Pictures with guest Marv Newland, who has been a part of the animation scene for over 40 years. His raunchy and subversive short films have earned him worldwide notoriety. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, Willamette Radio Workshop with Sam A. Mowry will feature two new original productions from their writers on the air series for Halloween. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our humble, terrorist-exempting broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks for joining us. Have a good night.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th. Today you can join Portland Center Stage for a panel discussion exploring parallel themes in current and upcoming works by PCS, Readers Theater Repertory, and the Inside Out Theater Collective. The panel will discuss and engage the audience in issues of identity, the artist, and civic responsibility, and the ethics of loyalty, as well as corollaries between the rising tide of fascism in the early 20th century and the specious currency of civil liberties in contemporary society. The event is free and open to the public, and refreshments will be served. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. and is located in the Studio Girding Theater at the Armory on 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. For more information, call Tim DeRoach at 503-445-3794. For a little fun today, you can go to the Multnomah County Library Midland Branch for a free Day of the Dead and Halloween activity night. You can see an exposition of altars and join in games and other fun accompanied by Mexican folk music. Wear a costume and join the costume parade. The event is from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. and is located at the Multnomah County Library on 805 Southeast 122nd Avenue in Portland. For more information, contact 503-988-5392. You can come to the OMSI Science Pub today for a free discussion on the origins of life on Earth with Dr. Niles Lemon, Professor of Chemistry at Portland State University. Dr. Lemon will explore problems in studying the origins of life and will tell about some insights and advances towards solving the puzzle of the beginning of life on Earth. The discussion begins at 7 p.m. and is located at the Bridgeport Brew Pub and Bakery on 1313 Northwest Marshall in Portland. For more information, contact ScienceHub at omsi.edu or visit www.omsi.edu. If you want to enhance your personal connection to the community and nature, you can join the weekly Naturalist Skills Community Night by Cascadia Wild today. At Naturalist Skills Community Night, folks get together and learn some aspects of fire, water, shelter, food, tracking, bird language, and more. These gatherings give everyone an opportunity to meet folks, learn stuff, and have a lot of fun. Everyone is welcome. The event is from 7 to 9 p.m. For more information, visit www.cascadiawild.org or call 503-235-9533. You have been listening to the KBOO Community Calendar for Monday, October 30th, 2006. This is KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
This is Lane Ponce, and I'm here with KBOO's Labor Radio Show on Fifth Monday. My co-host, Tim Flanagan, is here with us. Tim, why don't you give us a rundown on what we're going to do tonight?
Well, we have several guests tonight. Tom Chamberlain gave me a call a couple hours ago, and he may or may not make it in, but he definitely will be calling in, perhaps sometime after 6:15.
And Tom is the president of the AFL-CIO of Oregon.
Yes, he is. He's president of AFL-CIO Oregon. Leslie Frayne is here in the studio. She's the executive director of SEIU Local 503. Michael Morrow is also here in the studio. He's the vice president for the Committee on Political Education for Portland Community College Faculty Federation. And Garrett Downen, the director of the Oregon Bus Project, is in transit, and in fact, I think he's coming in the door right now.
Hi, Garrett. We're happy to see you.
I am so glad to be here, right on time.
Very close to on time. And what we know about Garrett is that he's on the run. He's with the Bus Project, and he's coming in the door. He's going to have a few minutes to tell us about the Bus Project, and then he's running down to do some more voter work, right?
Absolutely.
Let me give you the mic and tell us about the Bus Project.
Bus Project, a bold new form of hands-on democracy. We've got, you know, a general sense out there that there's not as much civic participation as would be perfect. We're trying to answer that. One of the things we've been doing is combining fun with politics for a couple few years now. Trick or vote was something we did last night. It's, every Halloween season seems to be followed by an election in even-numbered years. So why not take advantage of the fact that people are out on the streets, knock on doors, talk with their neighbor.
That's a pretty good idea. Now, give us a little history of the bus project, because it's kind of for young people, but yet you let other people get involved too, right?
Young people of all ages, I like to say. The young at heart. So everyone from my 13-year-old little brother to Joe Smith, he calls himself the token old guy on the bus, but there's many folks who are on the who are of retirement age who are helping out in all ways that they can. In fact, we've got a phone bank going on right now with Mike Litt, is one of the state's best canvassers, but he's putting down the sneakers for the evening and helping us make some phone calls tonight to get out the vote.
Okay, now the bus project is literally that. It's a bus, and you load it up with people, and you go into districts that are marked for progressive and labor leaders, and then you go in and you help canvass. Tell us more about that. Do you do the whole state, or how does that work?
Well, for volunteer-driven democracy to be able to make as much of a difference as seemingly endless pits of dollars make, if you're looking on a campaign finance donation side of things, you want to apply the volunteer labor as much like a scalpel in precise place as you possibly can. So we work with other certified smart groups. We work alongside labor and other groups with progressive interests. And our bus pack group does do feet on the street work for candidates. It's been proven that the most effective way of talking with a voter is by knocking on their door and talking with them. Calling them doesn't hurt. Giving them some literature doesn't hurt either. But that's the most effective way. And volunteers do that better than almost anybody else, because a person behind the door seems to be able to tell that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart.
You mentioned something called the Certified Smart Group. What exactly does that mean? Who's smart? Who's not?
Oh, sure. No. No smoky back rooms. It's come one, come all in terms of getting on board volunteering, not just in to come out and canvass for the day, even though we try to put on as friendly a volunteer day as you can. We're holding our last bus trip of the season this Saturday, going down to Salem. We'd invite everybody to come there, but no, come in and volunteer during the week and help us plan these things.
Where would a person come into to help volunteer, or is there a website or a telephone number we can have?
In fact, there is www.busproject.org. We've got at the moment we've got voter guides linked up there. We've got links to ballot measure endorsements from newspapers and ballot drop sites and any sort of voter information you could hope for, as well as information about these upcoming events. We're busy, busy, busy for the next few days before the November 7th deadline.
And don't you have an office down there by moveon.org?
We are down. Exactly, yeah. They're in the neighborhood there, right by Produce Row Cafe. We're at the intersection of Southeast Oak and 2nd Avenues.
Oak and 2nd.
Yeah.
Do any of our other guests here have questions for Mr. Garrett Downen with the bus project?
Well, I just want to say on behalf of the members of SEIU how much we've enjoyed working with the bus project. We've done a bunch of joint canvases in Eugene and in the Salem area. And for our members, I think there's something particularly inspiring to work with young people. Our members, of course, run the gamut in age from early 20s to many retirees. But we average a little bit older than the bus project volunteers. And I think we've been invigorated by the young energy that the bus project brings and really enjoy working together.
That's the beauty of working across a number of issue areas is we get to work with so many marvelous groups, and labor, of course, works across issue areas as well. So it's we overlap so much and enjoyed working with SEIU as well as another number of other unions as well.
This is Michael. As an aging boomer who's just about a year and a half away from Social Security, I would like to say I enjoy getting your regular email posts, and I would invite listeners, if they're interested in following the bus project, to go to the website, get hooked up, and every week or two you get a fascinating email that details all the wonderful events these folks are doing.
The surprise, the fun you can have with graphic design. You got volunteers all over the place who love messing around in Photoshop.
Tim, you have any questions for our guest?
What's your primary concerns in this last 8 days?
Getting out the vote. Of course, we've got The bus project, there's several affiliated groups. There's the candidate group, the bus pack, and they're working with candidate campaigns in these very targeted state legislative districts to make sure Oregon's pointed forward in the coming legislative session. And so we're getting out the vote with them. And then they're more generally working on making sure that the youth voting, the youth turnout doesn't go down like it had been doing every single year since 1972, when 18-year-olds were given the right to vote. We had gone down every year up until 2004. We'd like to try to keep it at as high a level as we can.
So if somebody wants to make a difference, they can come out there and pound the pavement with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've got events left and right. Check out busproject.org, and or give us a call. We'll get you plugged in. The phone number is 503-233-3018.
Okay, would you like us to liberate you out the door? Or do you have some more things you'd like to share with us before you go?
Well, I hate to just swing in and say hello. I'll hang out and sit in the background and chuck along with you for a few minutes. But I appreciate you guys having me on. And thank you to all your listeners who are getting involved and helping their communities in this most critical time for democracy.
Okay, let's move around with our guests, and if you think of anything you want to say, let me know. Grab the mic, or do you really want to get back to your phone work?
Well, if you're letting me get back to on the street and on the phone, I'll hit that and do what I can. So I'll see your listeners out there.
Okay, thank you very much for flying through, and it was great talking with you. And keep up the good work.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Garrett.
Okay, Tim, you want to do some introductions here around the table?
Okay, we have at the table here, we have Lane Ponce.
Yes, of course, with CWA,
and
Communication
you are
Workers.
With the Communication Workers of America, Local 7901.
Retired.
And I'm with Portland Community College Faculty Federation. I'm a vice president for part-timers. And Michael Morrow, on my right, is the vice president is vice president of the Committee for Political Education for Portland Community College Faculty Federation. And he has several things to present here tonight. And Leslie is here as executive director of SEIU Local 503. And Leslie, what are your primary concerns in these last 8 days?
Well, I think that we're feeling cautiously optimistic about a number of the key races. It feels like we're on track in the gubernatorial election. I think we have high hopes about the legislative races, although the control of particularly the state house is going to come down to a few very close races that are going to turn on a couple hundred votes if history continues its normal course. I think in terms of what we're most anxious about right now, I'd have to say it's some of the ballot measures where the polling shows that in some cases, a majority of Oregon voters are still saying that they're undecided, which I think has to do with a great deal of confusion out there, some of the advertising and just the sheer quantity of measures that are on the ballot. And I'm very concerned that there may be working people who vote counter to their self-interests because the messages haven't been clear.
So many of those measures are presented in one way, and they actually have the opposite effect. Which measures are you most concerned with?
I think the two that are on the top of the concern list are probably 41 and 48. 48 is the so-called taxpayer bill of rights, modeled on a measure that was in effect in Colorado for over a decade and really decimated public services in Colorado. Things got so bad there that voters voted to repeal it earlier this year in a repeal effort led by many of the same Republican and business leaders who had originally sponsored the measure. What we saw in Colorado is the quality of public services declining from a point where Colorado had ranked in the top 10 states in the country in terms of the level of funding for education and has now declined to the bottom 10. It's 49th out of 50 in funding for higher education and actually ranks 50th out of the 50 states for the level of childhood vaccination. And what that's about is the effect of TABOR, which limits what the state can spend, even in years when revenues are booming because the economy is doing well. And it's clear that if a similar measure is passed in Oregon, if Measure 48 passes, we're going to see deterioration of all of the public services that we rely on, education, health care, public safety, and roads. And I think that that's something that, that Oregonians, we just can't afford as a state to see more deterioration of services.
So it's a one-size-fits-all initiative, and it eliminates the flexibility you need to react to situations that occur.
Sure, and I'm not sure it really fits anybody. The formula that it would impose on state spending is totally arbitrary, and it ignores the fact that the population groups that rely most on public services, kids who need to go to school, seniors who need health care, those populations are growing faster than the general population. So to expect state spending to grow at the same rate as population and still meet the need is just massively unrealistic. I think anybody who looks at it very closely would say this is just bad public policy. It's bad for Oregon, and it really deserves a no vote. Measure 41 is a little bit different, although for the members of my union, really all they need to know about Measure 41 is that Bill Sizemore sponsored it. And our history with Bill Sizemore is such that, you know, essentially anything he supports, I think working people in the state can be pretty confident that a no vote is in order. But what Measure 41 would do specifically is substitute the federal tax deduction for dependents for the state tax credit, and it would be essentially an across-the-board tax cut, but it would save working families very little money. I think the estimate is about $69 per year per dependent. At the same time, it would create a $700 million hole in the state budget. It would even take effect retroactively, so it would affect the current biennium in which the budget has already been approved. You know, and the right wing would like you to think that, well, you can make up that cost by cutting waste. But there are two problems with that. One is there is not nearly as much waste in the state budget as the right wing and the media would have you believe. There's some, of course, but not nearly as much as the pundits often say. And furthermore, what's there, I don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to be able to target. So what the effect of a $700 million hole in the state budget is going to be is cuts in those areas of the state budget where most of the spending takes place. That's education, that's health care, that's public safety. Those areas combined are 93% of the state funding, state spending in this state, and if you cut those areas by 7%, we're going to pay a price in terms of the quality of education, in terms of our access to health care, in terms of our collective public safety. Oregon can't afford Measure 41.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation throughout the evening, and right now, Mr. Tom Chamberlain is on the phone. And he is the president of the AFL-CIO. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Good morning, everyone, or good
afternoon.
Evening.
Oh, you're running behind or ahead, right?
It's been a very long day. Hi, Leslie. How you doing?
Hi, Tom.
Okay. Field some questions there.
Sure.
Tom.
Yeah.
We were just discussing Measures 41 and 48, and why should we vote against those?
Well, I think Leslie, I heard what she had to say, and she's absolutely right. The only thing I'd add on 48 in particular is it's actually worse than Colorado Tabor in that the Colorado Tabor allowed for fees, so that fees could actually make up some of the loss in revenue. That's not true for Oregon. And another thing that folks should think about is that Tabor actually has a ratcheting effect. In bad times, you know, we go through a recession, what happens? Income drops, spending drops, revenue drops. And since this is a spending limit, when we go through a recession, we actually decrease the amount of money that we can spend. When we come out of the recession, we have a rebound effect, and we actually have an increase in revenue. And we're experiencing that right now. Under Tabor, there's no rebound. You're stuck at that recession level. That becomes the ceiling for your spending.
So just when you need those extra amounts to repair the damage done, you can't spend the money.
No.
If I might jump in for a second here, this is Michael. Driving over here, I heard one of those cheerful Yes on 48 ads that they're calling it the Rainy Day Fund. And I think this is directly applicable to what Tom just said. A lot of folks are going to vote for this believing that it does, in fact, create a rainy day fund. It does not. Don McIntyre himself, who is one of the backers of it, says it does not create a rainy day fund. There's not the word rainy day in it at all. So rather than doing what they assert it is going to do in the ads, which is build up this fund that people have come to realize Oregon really needs, or maybe the only state in the country that does not have a rainy day fund for difficult times. Because we have the kicker structured in, this is not going to allow us to accumulate money to get into those hard times and get over those hard times. It, in fact, is going to, as Tom points out, dig us a deeper and deeper hole. I would like to suggest to anyone listening who would like to find out the Colorado experience, go to the website, www.defendoregon.org. And on that website, they have a video that was made by the folks in Colorado who talk about this very thing, about the promises of all this extra money being available because of this measure, and it just didn't materialize. What the Coloradans experienced instead was declining resources across the board in education, and in every other aspect of what's going on to support people's lives that the state contributes to. So there's that, and anyone who's interested, a Republican who was head of one of the houses in Colorado, a gentleman named Bradley J. Young, has written a great little book on Tabor. I read it, and I highly advise anyone to read it. And this man's a Republican who, when that measure was introduced in Colorado, thought it was going to be a great thing, and less than a decade later, he is writing a book saying, as part of the title of his little series of essays, he's calling it The End of Democracy. His fear is that the whole initiative process, the way it's being used by a few people with a lot of money, in fact, is seriously damaging our ability to be a democracy. So I just thought I'd throw that out.
If you look at both measures 41 and 48, almost all of the funding to get them on the ballot and to run the campaigns comes from out of state. And in both cases, most of the funding comes from one wealthy individual. And I think it's time that Oregon stand up against people from out of state trying to use Oregon as sort of a sandbox or a laboratory to try out bad ideas. Oregon is appealing in that way because since we're a relatively small state, it doesn't take as much money to get a ballot measure on the ballot in Oregon as it would, say, in Colorado. So we're being used as guinea pigs by folks from out of state. One of the things that's encouraging, I think, about the Defend Oregon project that Michael talked about is within the state who's stepped up to oppose 41 and 48. I think it would be fair to say that Defend Oregon, that the majority of the money has come from working people, from trade unions, AFL trade unions, Change to Win unions. But what's interesting is that we've also seen the business community step up. All three major business alliances in the state, AOI, OBA, and OBC, have come out against Tabor and some of them against Measure 41 as well. And I think that it's interesting when even the business community recognizes that this measure just goes too far and poses a threat to their continued economic viability. The business community needs a good higher education system so that they can have a trained workforce. They need a good infrastructure so that they can transport the goods. So that if you look at within Oregon, there's really incredible unanimity both from business and from labor that these two measures move us in the wrong direction.
And Tom, what's on your list of things to do?
I just want to say one thing about Tabor. I mean, mm-hmm. Leslie's right on, but just one more point I'd like to make. Since Tabor prohibits increase in fees to make up for lost revenue, such as increases in tuition, things of that nature. My fear is, what's that going to do to the public education, higher ed, K through 12? I think it really leads us down to a path of privatization where only the wealthy can afford good schools. I mean, what we want in this state is good schools for all kids, not just the wealthy, but for everyone. And I think Tabor, in particular, makes that less likely to happen as we proceed down this path 10, 20 years from now.
I think you're right, Tom. What we really want is public education to be extended rather than having it reduced.
That's right. And
ideally, every citizen should get a college education.
And that hasn't always been so in this country, and that's part of what makes America unique and has built a strong middle class along with a vital labor movement, and we want to keep the United States equal as much as possible in education and opportunities for all folks, not just the wealthy.
I think Tabor is incredibly dangerous, but I also worry that we can sometimes sound very gloomy by only talking about the threats that we face. And there is one ballot measure that we have an opportunity to vote on, which I think we can enthusiastically support, and that's ballot measure 44, which has to do with health care. Ballot measure 44 would expand access to Oregon's bulk purchasing pool for prescription drugs, and it would make prescription drugs more affordable for Oregonians who lack insurance. It would also create an option for small businesses to participate in the pool and take advantage of the lower costs that Oregon can negotiate because it negotiates for such a large number of covered lives. This is the expansion of the history on this is interesting because the Oregon Drug Purchasing Pool was created in the 2003 legislature, an initiative heavily backed by my union and others to create the pool, recognizing that the high cost of prescription drugs was crippling our ability to negotiate good contracts for our members, but equally important, making it just impossible for Oregonians from working families throughout the state, union or non-union, to get the prescriptions that they needed. And we tried in the last so the prescription purchasing pool was established in 2003. We tried in 2005 to expand it, and our efforts were blocked by the Republican leadership of the House that would never, led by Speaker Karen Menace, who would never allow a vote on the expansion of the prescription drug purchasing pool. And it was just a very clear example of where the pharmaceutical company's influence impeded democracy and ran completely counter to the needs of working families in this state. So after that defeat in the legislature at the hands of the Republican leadership, SEIU, the AARP, a number of other groups got together and said, well, if we can't get this through the legislature, we're going to try to do it on the ballot. We succeeded in getting it in the ballot. And one of the things that's interesting is that the pharmaceutical company, after fighting it very hard in the legislature, has been very reluctant to put money into fighting it at the ballot because they know just how immensely popular this is. It's really hard for people to come out against lower-cost prescription drugs. So we have an opportunity here to pass this. I think it will pass. If you look at the voter pamphlet, there is actually no vote no statement on this issue. There's such unanimity on it. But I wanted to take a minute to talk about it just because I sometimes feel like we're saying vote no on everything, and it feels very negative. Our union and some other groups, Defend Oregon, have been saying vote yes on 44 and no more, because 44 is the one good one in the pack that I think we can wholeheartedly support, and it will not transform our healthcare system, but it will allow us to make incremental progress toward expanding access and affordability of healthcare for all Oregonians.
Leslie, I really appreciate your bringing that to the fore. We're always told what not to vote for, and 44 and no more is a good motto. I know that the various unions have endorsed various statewide ballot measures, but I think that's a pretty good guide.
So, Tom, you want to give us your top three concerns for this election year?
Well, I think 41, 48. I agree 44 is a long time coming on health care. I'm concerned about ballot measures 46 and 47, campaign finance reform. I mean, I think it's deceptive to progressives. I think they can look at this and say, hey, look, let's get big funders out of campaigns. Let's get the Howard Riches and the Lauren Parks out, and let's have a level playing field. The problem is 47 and 46 do not do that. Peter Buckley, Representative Buckley, had a great, in my opinion, piece in the Oregonian on the 27th, and he was one of the chief petitioners of 46 and 47, and that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to get big dollars out of politics. In exchange, they put limits on nonprofits, including unions. And when they ran that by constitutional attorneys and national consultants, what they found out was that limits on big donors would probably be thrown out, and what would be left are limits on unions and nonprofits, basically a muzzle on the voice of the voters, the working folks of this state. So I'm very concerned about those two measures. I'm very concerned about what it'll do to the political dynamic in this state if they were to pass. And remember, 46 goes into the Constitution.
Okay. Now, well, why stop here? Tell us some more of your concerns.
Other ballot measures?
or candidates that you're backing, or whatever you want to talk about.
Of course, we're backing Ted Kulongowski for governor. We think that's a clear choice. He's has a very pro-labor record. He's the first governor in the country to endorse the Employee Free Choice Act. Not only did he enjoy it, and the Employee Free Choice Act, remember, is a federal legislation that would provide for card check for organizing. Remember that card check is a different way to have an election for union folks to form a union. Instead of having election, they simply sign up for, sign a card to join the union. It's what they have in Canada. Increases fines on bad employers and binding arbitration for first contracts. He also has never supported a trade agreement. He's actually actively campaigned against trade agreements, going so far as to send a letter to the World Trade Organization asking them to exempt Oregon from some of the GATT rules that take away local control, especially on siting big box stores and other issues like that. So we have a clear choice. And then we have Mr. Saxton, who's very short on specifics on what he's going to do in this state, short of firing all public employees and hiring them back. And so I think the choice for governor is clear. I'm very excited about what may happen in the legislative races. It appears to be a Democratic year. We have a great field program. I think all of organized labor and progressive groups have joined together trying to get the vote out, and I think that's going to pay some dividends in this election.
Okay, and I assume that you're very busy this evening.
Yes, I'm running a phone bank this evening.
Okay, so yeah.
So I'm doing double duty.
Were you aware that Garrett Downen was here with the Oregon Bus Project right before you called?
No, I wasn't.
He's no longer here. He also came in and took off to do a phone bank, so we'll turn you loose to get back to the phone bank, too. Thank you very much for calling in.
You bet. Bye.
Thanks, Tom.
That was Tom Chamberlain, the president of the AFL-CIO Oregon, and he's working on campaign phone banks tonight. So it's just about 6:32, and you are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we are going to call for an invitation for call-ins anytime in the last half of the show. So if you'd like to call in and talk with any of the people here or voice your opinion, 503-231-8187. Okay, take off.
I'll agree to that. Please do call us at 503-231-8187. We'd like to hear from you. And I'd like to say something about what Tom was saying about our choices for governor. It seems to me there is only one choice. We have a governor. Kulongowski has done a great job. His record speaks for itself. Mr. Saxton knows what he's against, but he doesn't seem to know what he's for. And he knows what's wrong, but he doesn't know how to fix it. So I think we have a clear choice. We have an inexperienced naysayer, and we have an experienced administrator in place. And I'm going to vote for Mr. Kulongowski myself.
Well, I'm afraid Bob Caldwell, who's editorial page editor of the Oregonian, is not going to line up with you and make that vote. I thought their endorsement of Mr. Saxton was deja vu all over again. He, in his Apologia column Sunday before last, could have actually just cut and pasted the same column that he wrote following their endorsement of Mr. Bush in 2000. It was a minority endorsement of the editorial board for basically the same reasons. We need, they said, while Mr. Gore is certainly a competent administrator, while Mr. Kulongowski is certainly a competent administrator, we need new ideas. We need a new vision. We need, and they, in 2000, they fell for the uniter, not a divider. They fell for, you know, all the platitudes about, you know, no nation building, about, conservative conscience. It fell for all of those, and I'd like to do Dr. Phil's question to Mr. Caldwell. How's that working out for you? How is the endorsement of Mr. Bush now sitting for you? And they came back and did the same thing with Mr. Saxton. He's a new vision, new ideas. Of course, he's not being specific about anything. And when asked, he says, "Oh, we'll just cut everybody's taxes and pay for everything with efficiencies." My fear is that a few years from now we will be asking the same question of Mr. Caldwell about their endorsement of Mr. Saxton. How's that working out for you?
The editorial talked about, you know, endorsing Saxton because we wanted leadership. Well, I think part of leadership is being able to tell people the truth instead of fantasies. And all of the Saxton campaign material is replete with fantasies. The idea that you can maintain services while cutting taxes, the idea that we can maintain quality of services while privatizing out to the lowest bidder and paying workers less and less. And you got to respect Governor Kulongoski for saying, you know, it would be easier for him to say, oh, no new taxes. That's always more popular in a campaign. But he's been willing to stand up and say, you know what, we need to increase the cigarette tax. We need to look at some insurance taxes. And finally, in this state, we need to do something about the outrageous corporate minimum tax, where so many corporations in this state pay $10 a year while working people pay a heavy burden to maintain the services that we all need. And I think that's leadership is telling the truth even when you're not sure people want to hear it.
You're right. They need to pay their share. And I think we have a caller on the line.
We do. Is the caller on the line?
Hello, yes.
Hi.
Okay. Hi, my name's April, and I live in Oregon City, and I'm a mother of two small children. And as a parent and also as a citizen in Oregon, I'm very concerned about all of the measures on the ballot except for 44, but specifically measures 41 and 48, because if they pass, they will limit the state budget to such a degree that we're looking at perhaps hundreds of teachers being fired, you know, dozens of schools closing, bringing class sizes up into the high 30s or low 40s. What that's going to do to the quality of education could just be horrible. If 41 and 48 pass, they could also raise our college tuitions by as much as 30% across the board. So there's just no way that we can have that, you know, that those kind of measures pass in Oregon. It'll be detrimental to everyone, working class, upper middle class, even the wealthy. I mean, we need an educated workforce. We need a strong state. So I hope that everyone will do their research and vote no on all those measures except for 44.
Okay,
thank
you very much, April. We have another caller coming in, and
okay,
thanks a lot,
have a
April.
Good night. Thank you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, do we have another caller on the line?
Hello?
Another caller? Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, I can just barely hear you.
Oh, okay.
There, that's better.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the governor's race. I guess I'm a little bit, I mean, I'm scared to death of Ron Saxton as a governor, but I'm concerned that that Ted Kulongoski has I guess fallen into the immigration wedge and has gone a little bit anti-immigrant in his campaign, and I just wish that was not the case. And I he sent out a mailer that basically it was the facts on immigration and talked about how he had done some things to, you know, stop the illegals, quote, from getting driver's licenses, and sent the National Guard, the Oregon National Guard, to the border to shore up the border. And I wish that he hadn't been sucked into that immigration wedge issue.
A couple things I would say on behalf of the governor's position regarding immigration. One is he has been a consistent supporter of collective bargaining rights for farm workers in this state, which is an issue of critical concern to the immigrant community. He has also stated publicly on many occasions, although I don't know that it appeared in that mailer, that he supports comprehensive immigration reform, which includes some enforcement, but also includes a path to legalization for the millions of immigrants in this country who work hard every day, putting food on our table and doing the work that we need to keep the economy booming. I do agree with you, however, that the entire debate on immigration and the extent to which it has shifted rightward and focused exclusively on enforcement is very troubling.
And I would agree. The immigration issue is difficult to communicate, even to progressive voters. Part of the problem is we don't discuss the elephant in the room, NAFTA, which is
the basic cause. A word on immigration issue, which is obviously a complex issue. This is Michael again. My wife and I just put a roof on our house not too many weeks ago. And the crew that put the roof on, there were probably a dozen all guys, were all from Mexico. And there was a crew chief. And I speak Spanish, so I had some nice conversations with these fellas. And my guess is, without asking too many questions, my guess is, no, it's a certainty. They were not members of a union. They were probably not getting high wages nor benefits. And what I would just like to put out there is there would be many instances like the cost of my roof that would change considerably if we were to do the sorts of things that Mr. Saxton and his party wants to do, which is put a fence up over the border. My guess is that while I would love to have a union crew putting a roof on my house, that $12,000 roof would probably cost me double that. And I think that may be the case in many, many arenas, and it's a complex issue. It has to do with people, you know, utilizing those workers and making, you know, profits off of them and not adequately compensating them. But it is for somebody who wants to think that there are simplistic responses out there to it, you might want to rethink it, because in many ways it's gonna affect a whole lot of people's pocketbooks to do the simplistic sorts of things that some people are advocating.
I also think of the many stories that didn't get enough play in this election season. Saxton's own history with undocumented workers is one of them. He is a partial owner of a farm in West Salem that had migrant workers, and when asked were the migrant workers documented, he said, "I don't know," which is a pretty clear-cut way of saying that they weren't. And yet that was okay with him, because his position on enforcing the law on immigration has always been that it should be enforced on the immigrants but not on employers who hire and exploit immigrant workers. And if we're going to talk about following the law, it needs to start with the governor of the state and candidates for governor.
Yes, it's a dichotomy between exploitation and cooperation rather than creating avenues where people can be exploited. We could instead enforce the law here at home. Rather than building walls, we can force large corporations to take care of their workers.
Is our caller still on the line? No, he's not. Okay, well, thank you very much for calling in. We got quite a bit of mileage out of that. Thank you very much.
I'd like to go back to comments that Leslie and Garrett made, and see if I can weave something together here in response to something that caller April talked about. She has young children, and she's concerned about education. I, of course, work at Portland Community College, and Leslie a few minutes ago was talking about good news. There is good news out there. In addition to the bulk drug purchasing, there have been attempts in the last two legislative sessions to create a pool of education workers in the state for purposes of pooling health care. It has been demonstrated in those last two sessions that had we been able to pool those folks, including myself and people who work in K-12 and a number of other people, it would be tens of thousands of employees. The savings to the state would have been $30 to $50 million. Yet the same person who blocked the drug purchase also blocked that from even getting a hearing. Ms. Minnis out there in 49 has gotten the attention of a lot of folks, including the aforementioned Oregonian, who are endorsing her opponent, basically for those kinds of reasons. There have been many, many things come before the legislature that died in the House without even a discussion, because we have one person who seems to be responding to moneyed interests, pulling the purse strings, and actually costing the people of this state a whole lot of money. So a piece of the good news there is that the voters of the state have an opportunity in District 49 and in some other districts to send a house to Salem in January, which may, in fact, help a whole lot of folks out around education. I'm thinking especially of community college students who have seen their tuition double in the last 5 to 6 years. Same thing in four-year schools and higher education. We obviously need some solutions, and we need to find a way to keep open the door to education for all of the people in the state.
Who did the Oregonian endorse for District 49?
Rob Harding.
Okay.
I couldn't agree more with that, and Rob Brading is clearly the right candidate for that race. You know, as a union, we work in SEIU really hard not to be partisan. We have members who are Democrats, members who are Republican, members who are unaffiliated. And so when we go to endorse candidates, we don't look at their party. We look at their position on the issues. And that's sort of an important principle for our union. And yet in this election in particular, we find ourselves more focused on party than we would like to be, because knowing which party has the majority in the House is going to determine whether Karen Minnis is Speaker or whether State Representative Jeff Merkley is Speaker. And given the power that the Speaker has to set the agenda in the House, to determine who are on committees and to determine what bills get hearings, what bills go to committees where they're going to die, what bills go to committees where they're actually have a possibility of being enacted, the Speaker is so much more powerful than any other member of the legislature. And since the majority party determines who the Speaker is, we really find ourselves in a position that even though we don't endorse candidates based on their party, I know I'm hoping that we have a Democratic majority because of the leadership issue. I think it's important that the labor movement not get too closely connected to any political party, because we don't have any permanent friends. We only have permanent issues. And there are certainly times when our relationship with the Democratic Party has felt a little bit like an unrequited love affair, where we give and we don't always get. Having said that, replacing Karen Minnis needs to be the top one of the top priorities for all union members in this state, and in fact, all working Oregonians.
Her record of obstruction is clear. I don't know what she has produced during her term in the legislature, but I do know what she's stopped the legislature from producing by getting in the way.
Absolutely.
And I'd like to go back to a thought I had about Garrett and those folks running around on the bus talking to 18 to 30-year-olds about voting. And there was just an article in the Oregonian a day or two ago about that, about a woman who tends bar, who is registered and will vote for the first time now, a gal in her late 20s. What I usually say to students at the college, at Portland Community College, and we, of course, had a major voter registration drive a few weeks ago, and we signed up, I think, an additional 1,500 people at our four campuses, most of them registering for the first time. 18, 20, 22-year-olds will say to me often, well, you know, this doesn't concern me. Nothing that's happening here, you know, really has anything to do with me. Oh, and my vote doesn't matter. My response to that is twofold. One is my state senator, Kate Brown, likes to mention that she won her first race by 8 votes. So this, as Leslie noted, this is going to be an election with a lot of very, very close races, and every vote really will matter. And then when the students say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with me, I ask them how much they paid for tuition. And this term at PCC, students are paying $69 a credit for tuition. 5 years ago, they were paying $35 a credit for tuition. That difference has mostly been because the state legislature, over the past 6 years, has actually, in real-life dollars, cut the amount of funds available to community colleges by about $60 million over 6 years. And that's not adjusting for inflation. That's actual dollars. So if we don't get that assistance from the state, we have to ask the students for it. And then the question I finish with is, you know, how many of you have friends in California going to community college? Anybody? And a few people do. Do you know what they're paying per credit? They're paying $22 a credit. Mm. Is that because it's less expensive to provide a college education in California? No, it's because in Sacramento, the legislators there who are elected by the people of Sacramento believe it is important to assist folks getting through that college door. And I feel committed to this because I went through that college door in California, and I got an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a master's degree for total less in tuition, because it was free in the 60s and 70s, less in tuition than a PCC student pays now for one term.
Oh, that's amazing. Let's give the bus project a plug here. Their website is www.busproject.org, and their telephone number is 503-233-3018. So if you want to get in touch with those folks and help with this last-minute push that they're working on, please do that.
One of the things that's been gratifying about this election is just how many people have, like Michael's students, recognized that this is about all of us. If you have kids in school, if you are in school, if you provide health care, if you need health care, if you drive on the roads, any of those public services, you're going to be affected. And I've been impressed with union members throughout the state really stepping up and volunteering. We have run phone banks in Eugene in Portland and in Salem for our members. And one of the nice things about a computerized phone system is that you get a running count on how many phone calls you've made. And as of this week, SEIU members have made 58,000 phone calls to voters throughout the state, our members, the members of other unions, the general public, talking to them about the issues. And I'm always amazed at how, despite the quantity of calls that I know people are getting, how pleased most people are when you take the time to actually explain the issues to them. So there are a million ways to get involved through the bus project, through your union, through the party apparatus, but there are lots of opportunities, and it makes such a difference.
And not to mention reading the two-volume voters pamphlet. Have we had a two-volume voters pamphlet before?
I'm not certain we have, but
it's almost an inch or two thick.
We may have, but I don't think the pages totaled 350 or whatever it is like they do now.
It's amazing. So, you know, maybe you'll get a call that will help you decide what to vote. So don't hang up until you find out.
Let me give the radio station a plug here. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Our call-in line is 503-231-8187. If you have some questions about this election, if you're concerned about who to vote for or what issue to vote on, give us a call and we'll talk about it.
Well, while we're taking sort of a little break in the flow, why don't you announce some of the things that are coming up that you know about, that you want people to know about? You got any political things happening, or you had a list of things?
Well, There are a lot of actions going on in town. If you go to activeresource.org, there's a list of activities you can get involved in. You can pound the pavement, like I said. You can walk around, knock on doors, and sometimes that's the most effective method, because when people see you sacrificing your time and energy just to make sure they get to the polls and vote, it makes a difference. There's phone banks and databases at several places, in addition to the bus project. .org. There's moveon.org, which has an office at 232 Oak Street, and they're happy to have volunteers work on their databanks. And I believe Michael has a few things with him.
No, Michael doesn't have a few things with him.
For activism.
He has a few things back in the office, but mostly pertinent to my federation, American Federation of Teachers,
right.
Local 2277. So, for our people, for AFT people, there's always the AFT Oregon website where you can find different ways to get involved, not just up to November 7th, assisting with turning out the vote for the election, but far beyond November 7th as well.
I did want to raise one issue. I was speaking with someone yesterday, and he said that he'd lost hope. He said he's thinking of leaving the country. He's concerned that there's no way we affect the process anymore. Should we be concerned about whether our votes are counted?
You know, there's two responses to that. One is, sure, go read Greg Palast or go read Stolen Again or go read, Robert Kennedy's piece in Rolling Stone and get all nervous about, the ballot boxes. I got a different take on that. I was doing some workshops in St. Louis a couple days ago, and one of the workshops I do is on generations, looking at boomers like myself and Gen Xers like my kids, and then Gen Y or the millennial kids, those born in 1982. To 1999, roughly, and having discussions, especially with millennials, with Gen Y folks. These are folks who are just now becoming old enough to vote. When we talk about issues, they are a completely different group of people. Because we would talk about something like, well, what about same-sex marriage? And they would look at each other and ask, what's the problem? Why is this even an issue? So I think something that's important to keep in mind is we have gotten to where we are today in great part because a number of folks 30, 35, 40 years ago sat down and said we need to take over this country. And they did a pretty good job taking over the U.S. Congress in 1994, taking over the White House in 2000. But it was a 30 or 40 year well thought out program. I think that
progressives, liberals, whoever the heck we are, people who believe in diversity, people who believe in opportunities for education and health care, I think we probably are looking at a 20, 30, 40-year endeavor here that's actually taking seed in a lot of young folks now. You know what they say, you have to just wait long enough and the people who disagree with you all die. And pretty soon things just shift. So I, you know, long term, I'm very optimistic about, you know, the next generation who hopefully will get to the polls on the 7th.
So we're the silent majority. We just need to speak up. I think we have another caller.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
What's on your mind this evening?
Well, it's refreshing to hear some good news from you guys. I was listening to NPR and the accountability of the weapons in Iraq is not perfect, and you know, it just seems a lot of bungling. Who's in power right now? So, you know, got to take a look at that. What I am, I guess, thinking about is how do we control corruption? Because it seems like whoever's in charge eventually gets corrupted, and in you know, it may even affect those that may initially have been considered, labor-driven, it seems like those with the money get corrupted, and that the money side needs way more oversight than the labor side, because it's hard to get corrupted by labor. That is what's on my mind, and I just want to know, even if, you know, the left wing does get in, how are we going to control corruption, and what can we do to control corruption if either side wins, even if the right wing wins? So I'm just thinking about that, because it seems to me that's the biggest problem.
Okay, we'll throw that out to our people here in the audience, and I will probably close with that question. And thank you very much for presenting it, and here we go.
Thank you.
I think ultimately it comes down to a question of accountability, and that for working people in this state and this country, ultimately we can't rely on any politicians to do our work for us, and that the only folks who are going to consistently stand up for the needs of working people are working people working together, which is what unions are all about. So I think that it comes down to accountability. It comes down to supporting candidates who stand by working families, but only as long as they stand by working families. And it comes down to keeping people involved in the process, because that's necessary in order for us to be able to hold anyone accountable. And I just want to close by saying that I agree with Michael about the level of hope in the country right now. I actually feel more hope than I have in many years, and some of that's driven by the national scene, where it feels like we really are seeing some real changes that aren't just about people being angry at Bush's idiotic performance in Iraq. It's a whole list of things, of people saying, you know what, maybe we've had it with this right-wing, pro-business, anti-worker approach. And so I think that there's a lot of good stuff going on in terms of people stepping up to the plate, standing up for our own needs as working families, and that involvement is the key to accountability, which ultimately I think is the key to addressing some of the corruption concerns that the caller is worried about.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments.
Do I have a quick minute here?
You do.
One of the episodes in my life that has been meaningful to me is watching the third or fourth world championship of the Chicago Bulls. In the dressing room afterwards, champagne is flowing, and Jerry Reinsdorf, a little tiny guy who is very rich and owned the Chicago Bulls, turned to Phil Jackson, the Zen master who coaches the Bulls. And Jerry says to him, Phil, what do you think it is that drives these players? I think it's fear and greed. And Phil Jackson, the Zen master, looks at him and says, no, I disagree. I think it's love and pride. And I think our nation is at a crossroads right now. I think the forces of fear and greed may have the upper hand for a while, but I think ultimately those who really seek to follow the path of love and pride are going to come out on top. So I'm optimistic.
Okay, that sounds great. You want to close here? We want to thank you all for joining us today, but we have to wrap up here and finish up with some music.
So, Tim? Michael, you don't think that America's happy with deficits, disaster, and dishonor? You think we can do better?
Think we can do better.
Absolutely, we can do better.
And okay. I think there is hope, too. I think most of America is going to stand behind that.
Thank you, Tom Chamberlain, Leslie Fran, Michael Morrow, Tim Flanagan, and Garrett Donnan. And we'll close with some music, and we'll see you next Monday from 6 to 7 on Labor News.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers Shopmen's Local 516 and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743. Listening to KBOO Portland, and I regret to inform you that Kevin Berry has not yet arrived to the station, but he's going to be here within a couple minutes, and in the meantime, I'm going to put on another CD of Ann Feeney that I grabbed out of the music library, because that is what you were just listening to, and I'm sure he'll be here within a very short while.
Shut down my plant when the recovery went sour. We're both out working for that minimum wage and wondering whatever happened to the 8-hour day. Oh, whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Can't feed a family now on one person's pay. I can't take much more, I just got one thing to say. Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? We got no time for the house, no time for the kids. This 80-hour week has put our lives on the skids. There's only one thing gonna take it away. We gotta bring back that 8-hour day. Oh, whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Can't feed a family now on one person's pay. I can't take much more, I just got one thing to say. Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Oh, the company keeps telling us that we want too much. I see most of them still got that Midas touch. Now all we ever wanted was a home of our own. Instead we're gonna bail out some savings and loans. The kids need attention, the house is a mess. Our marriage is buffering from all of this stress. I can't take much more, I just got one thing to say. Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Oh, whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Can't feed a family now on one person's pay. I can't take much more, I just got one thing to say. Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Whatever happened to the 8-hour day?
Thank you. I couldn't really close out tonight without singing this song that has come to mean so much to me, because I have seen courage and idealism and everything. You know, when they give you all this talk in school about what this country's supposed to be, about caring for each other and standing up for each other and one out of many and working together and liberty and justice for all, we know that our history has not served those ideals very well. But in Decatur, Illinois, that liturgy is being borne witness to every day by some of the most courageous, exciting, wonderful workers that it's been my privilege to know, and that is the workers at the A.E. Staley plant. If you've all been to Decatur, like you said, you've heard it already. Deadly corn. It's a war zone here today, right in the heartland. But our union's here to stay. These multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you all. There's a war on the workers.
There's a war on the workers.
There's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Deadly corn could be the death of you and me. We're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity. Each workday's been a battle in the toxics and the smell. It was bad enough with Staley, but with Tate and Lyle, it's hell. Oh, there's a war on the workers. It's a time we started calling the shots. Deadly corn. Workplace safety's just a joke. There's the dust, the BSS, asbestos, fire and smoke. Jim Beals was murdered outright, poisoned by P.O. But Tate and Lyle's philosophies die quickly or die slow. It's a war. Calling the shots. They can lock us out, they can lock us out. We will not give in. No more lies, no compromise. We'll battle till we win. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
organization.
It's a war on the workers.
And cooperation.
It's a war on the workers.
It's a war on the workers. It's a war at the Frontier Casino. It's a war at Firestone here in Decatur. It's a war at the AE Staley plant. Thanks to GATT and NAFTA, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers. Decatur, Illinois, it's time around this world. You know it's time we start on the shot. Thank you. Do y'all know why God invented whiskey? To make sure the Irish didn't take over. So this is a true Irish story. Pat and Mick are on the boat on their way over to the United States. And Pat says to Mick, "Well, Mick, have you got employment when you get to the United States?" "Oh, indeed I have," he says. "Me brother's got me a fine job in the building trades." "Oh, the building trades," says Pat. "Don't you know that's dirty, dangerous work? You'll be taking your life in your hands." Mick says to Pat, "Well, Mr. Fancy Pants, what sort of employment have you secured for yourself in the United States?" "Oh, it's a little bit explained to me," says Pat. "Me Uncle William tells me the streets in the United States is paved with gold. I intend to support myself by picking up the gold I find in the streets." "Oh, you're daft," says Mick. "You'll be carrying a hod like me soon enough." But don't you know, they go through customs at Ellis Island. Their first day on American soil, they set foot on Manhattan Island, and there, right in front of them, on the street, was a $20 gold piece. Pat elbows Mick. "There now, don't you see me uncle was right? The streets is paved with gold, just like he said." And he saunters right on past the coin. Mick says, "Well, aren't you going to pick it up, man?" He says, "You forget yourself. This is Sunday. I'll start work tomorrow."